need somebody. Help. Not just anybody. Help. You know I need someone. Help.
In 1965, the Beatles released four new albums, including Help. LBJ announced his war on poverty at home while also escalating the war in Vietnam. Martin Luther King led a bloody civil rights march from Selma to Montgomery while an assassin took the life of Malcolm X. Women's skirts got shorter while men's hair got longer. Race riots exploded in Watts while university campuses held their first anti-war teach-ins. James Baldwin debated William Buckley on the meaning of freedom. What a year. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. In this hour, we explore 1965, the year the 60s changed. My guest is Professor Emeritus of Afro-American Studies, Craig Werner, author of acclaimed books such as A Change is Gonna Come, Race, Music, and the Soul of America, Higher Ground, Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder, Curtis Mayfield, and the Rise and Fall of American Soul, and We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War, chosen by Rolling Stone magazine as the best book of the year for 2015. His most recent book project is called Freedoms, A New History of the 60s. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Good to be back.
My first question is the title of your book project, Freedoms. Why plural?
Because during the 60s, the idea of freedom was contested. People argued about the definition. People argued about what it meant. They argued from all sides. Everybody on every side of every issue presented themselves as being in support of some kind of freedom. When William Buckley and James Baldwin faced off at Cambridge University, they were serious about it. They didn't leave it on the bumper sticker or soundbite level. They got down into the roots, the deep philosophical roots, the implications of what they were talking about. And those arguments defined the year and really defined the decade.
So pretty much everyone was talking about wanting freedom, but it meant something different.
Very different to different people. I mean, the biggest example of that was the Cold War, where the West, North America, Western Europe, cast themselves as the defender of freedom against slavery, where as the Soviet Union cast itself as the supporter of liberation of the masses. And from there on down to the Republicans and the Democrats and SDS, Students for Democratic Society, and the Washington establishment, all the way down, people presented them, marched under the banner of freedom.
We could take any year out of history, and there's so much that goes on with music, with politics, with social history, Supreme Court decisions, all kinds of things. Why does 1965 stand out to you as a sort of pivotal year?
Journalist Nicholas Lehman said it best when he said that during the summer of 65, the 60s swung as if on a hinge. You can almost draw a line somewhere, probably August of 1965, when the tone of the 1960s changed in a really, really fundamental way from the assertion of civil rights, the development of the Great Society programs, the celebration of Lyndon Johnson's first 2 years in the presidency, to something much darker, much more violent, much more disquieting than it happened before. You can see that in the fact that the Voting Rights Act, in many ways the culmination of a fight for African-American rights, the rights of all American citizens to vote, the culmination of well more than a century, passes Congress in early August, and 10 days later, Watts explodes in a violence that's variously called an uprising, a riot, a rebellion, a revolution.
I know with Lyndon Johnson, LBJ as president, kind of he's a giant figure hovering over this year, 1965. I've heard you in the past refer to him as almost a Shakespearean character, a giant, tragic, complicated. Tell us about LBJ and what kind of 1965 has to say about him.
Yeah, the New York Times columnist Tom Wecker in early 1965 wrote that Lyndon Johnson might be the best John Wayne part ever written. He seems 20 feet tall, when in reality he measures no more than 10.
That's ironic.
One of Johnson's aide said that if Johnson said he was going to fly Pegasus to the moon in 1965, he would have expected him to wave down from the moon. When he took over from John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson was on the fringes of politics. There was talk that he might not be renominated as a vice president for Kennedy. But when he took over, he did an absolutely brilliant job of steadying the nation, of pushing a legislative agenda in Kennedy's name that was largely not Kennedy's agenda. Kennedy had no particular intention of pushing and nor ability to push the Civil Rights Bill through Congress, but Johnson picked it up and ran with it. His Great Society, where he talked about the quality of men's characters being as important as the quantity of their goods. He passed through an incredible amount of progressive legislation. So for anybody on the political left, what Johnson accomplished in the first last half of 1964, the first half of 1965 was stunning. It was literally unprecedented, and there's never been anything close to it.
Now, when you're talking about the Great Society, what kinds of things mattered for people's daily lives?
Medical care, the Head Start programs, environmental programs. Johnson actually used the term green to describe that part of his agenda. Aid to education was at the center of his education. He believed strongly that you should give people he called it a hand up, not a handout, provide them with the education to move for themselves. He believed that communities should be in control of the programs that affected them. The problem was, and Johnson knew it, that he had a limited window to attain his goals, and that he and his aides were aware that in some ways they were moving too fast, that they could never get the legislation passed if they waited much longer. But because they moved so quickly, they didn't have time to pay attention to many of the details. Sergeant Shriver, the Peace Corps director, a Kennedy relative, who was in charge of first the Peace Corps and then put in charge of the War on Poverty, just shook his head, saying there's too much here to attain so quickly. And for a variety of reasons, the fabric started unraveling around Johnson. The other big issue, the reason he's Shakespearean to me, is that he got into the war in Vietnam for political reasons at a time when his real love was for the domestic agenda. He wanted to fulfill the promises of Abraham Lincoln. He wanted to make good on America's promise of equal citizenship for all, equality before the law. And he pushed hard, but he was afraid of attacks from the political right. He was afraid of being portrayed as soft on communism. And he more or less muddled his way into a Vietnam War that later he deeply, deeply regretted. Yet, step by inexorable step, we wound up into it. It's like Christopher Marlowe's play Dr. Faustus, where every step of the way, Faustus knows that he is making bad decisions, but he says, well, I made the last one. I have to continue to make it. And pretty soon he loses his soul.
Yeah, I've seen those quotes from LBJ where you can tell he knows the war is not going to help him. It's not going to go the way he wants, but he's stuck.
But he feels like he's stuck with it at any rate. You know, whether there's an alternate universe where that doesn't happen, we'll never know.
And was anything significant at that time with the Supreme Court and some of the decisions that are being made?
Yeah, the support that Johnson had for his policies was really unprecedented. He had massive majorities in both the House and the Senate. He was, by the end of 1964, his popularity rating, he had a positive rating of almost 70% amongst registered Republicans. Massive public support for what he was doing. And he had a Supreme Court headed by Chief Justice Earl Warren that was willing to work in advance of public consensus, that the decisions that they made during the high point of the Great Society were amazing. They passed laws closing voting loopholes. They provided the support of the right to demonstrations. They demanded equality in legislative districts. It was the high tide of American liberalism. There was no question about that. And through the middle of 1965, Lyndon Johnson really was a towering figure, exerting a degree of control probably unprecedented in American political history.
Craig, I know a lot of the work you've done is on music as sort of, you know, a beacon, a way of looking at history that we don't always think about. If you, in this time period that we're talking about with LBJ towering large, right as the 60s is on a hinge, is there a song that you can point to where it helps us get into this time period?
Well, I think you hear the Beatles calling for help, and almost exactly the same time, the Rolling Stones release a song that really captures the discontent that's bubbling under the surface. I can't get no satisfaction.
And you see the I can't get no satisfaction is sort of referring to what exactly happening in this time period.
Everything. It's the by the end of the summer, the young people, students for Democratic Society would undergo a fundamental change in their approach. The civil rights movement would move to the verge of the Black Power movement. And despite everything going so well on the surface, the Stones really articulated something about the dissatisfaction underneath.
I saw a quote from Mick Jagger in 1995, so 30 years later, telling Rolling Stone that the song has a very catchy title and it encapsulated the feeling of the time, which was alienation. So what exactly are they feeling alienated by and from?
Well, the alienation goes deep into the, I think, the early 1960s in some ways, where you have a generation of young people that's experiencing unprecedented affluence. Their parents grew up in the shadow of the Great Depression and World War II, but the baby boomers, as they came to be called, were experiencing something very different. But they were also experiencing the shadow of nuclear destruction. They were feeling the fact that everything that was being so shiny and new on the surface was covering up a world where they saw an awful lot of alcoholism, where they saw a lot of inequality, where they saw a big gap between the promise of the rhetoric of John Kennedy's New Frontier, Johnson's Great Society, and what they were seeing happening in the inner cities, in rural areas, that gap was eating at them. And feeling that the world was not delivering the kind of meaning, the spiritual fulfillment, the social fulfillment that they expected.
And what about sort of the counterculture movement at that point?
Well, the counterculture grew up in many ways as a movement that was supporting the African-American freedom movement, the civil rights movement. David Harris, who was one of the major voices in the counterculture and would become famous particularly for his commitment to draft resistance, talked about the fact that there had been a transfer in the focus from the emphasis on civil rights to, as Vietnam grew, the emphasis on draft resistance, that there had been a shift there. It was never an either-or. Most people in the movement, and he talked about the fact that it was capital T, capital M at the time, were in support of both. But there's no question but that the impetus for the growth of the movement, the radicalization of the movement, was the war in Vietnam. Carl Oglesby, who was the president of SDS by later 1965, talked about the movement from protest to resistance, that there had been a belief earlier in the decade that a protest movement that drew attention to the injustices and the inequities would result in change. That began to erode. That belief began to erode. And there began to be a sense growing that would cascade in the late 1960s that what was needed was direct resistance to the oppressive mechanisms, that it wasn't enough to say this is wrong, we should change it, that if it was necessary to disobey the laws, if it was necessary to confront the powers that be, then that would happen. And it wasn't always polite. And the generally polite tone of the protest of the early 1960s, you think of the March on Washington with no violence whatsoever, with 250,000 people there. By the end of 1965, there was a sense that there was violence on the very, very near horizon.
So you go from the "we have a dream" of 1963 to sort of a sense of a nightmare coming?
Yeah, or the sense for black power, or the calls for black power rather than the calls for freedom now, which disquieted many, many people, including, obviously, the liberals who had supported the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Act. That they said, what's going on here? What do these people want? And the young people began to, the Berkeley Free Speech Movement in 1964 heralded what was to come and fueled the sense that the young people were out of control. Ronald Reagan, who announced that he was running for governor of California at the very beginning of 1966, he'd made that decision the last week of 1965, made it clear that he was running against what he saw as disorder, impolite, rude, young people who needed to be taught their lesson and put back in their place. And that was a recipe for upheaval.
What about a figure like Sam Irwin?
Sam Irwin of North Carolina could always be counted on to articulate the conservative position without any kind of apologies whatsoever. And Lyndon Johnson was aware that as he passed the Great Society programs, that Irwin and others of his political approach were positioning themselves for what would soon be called a backlash. And Irwin says, responding particularly to Supreme Court decisions on school prayer and the urban upheavals, he says, "Enough has been done for those who murder and rape and riot. It is time to do something for those who do not wish to be murdered or raped or robbed." Well, that would be the core of the agenda that Ronald Reagan would rise would ride to power. Barry Goldwater had raised those issues in 1964 very unsuccessfully. But by the end of 65, they were getting some traction.
And would you say it would be called sort of the law and order approach?
Yes, absolutely the law and order approach, saying that we need to reestablish values. There was not yet an evangelical movement in 1965 with any political strength. Most evangelicals in 65 thought that they should keep their distance from politics. And the center of the religious culture at this point is really the reforms of Vatican II or transforming the practice of Catholicism in the United States. A lot of the mainstream Protestant denominations are losing their power. But mostly the religious emphasis politically is pretty progressive. It's a movement of Midwestern churches that gets the civil rights bill passed by convincing Republican representatives from the Midwest that their people want this. It was the moral high ground. By the end of 65, the redefinition of what freedom means is in process.
Also in process is a growing war in Vietnam, and we're going to look at that and also listen to Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
That's Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Craig Werner. We are talking about 1965, the year the 60s changed. So those lyrics are pretty strong.
Yeah, they reflect the feeling that the world was disintegrating, as he says. This whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And, you know, we're just within months of the time that Lyndon Johnson and the progressive agenda feels like it's ascendant in the world. And Barry McGuire, you know, is articulating something. He's articulating it in a way that causes a lot of questioning from the mainstream on that. That song in my hometown of Colorado Springs, military town, broke on the chart, record chart, at number one, and then was not heard. Again, the powers that be, the advertisers, decided that they did not want that voice being heard, which is part of what fueled the anti-war movement. Of course, it was too late by then. Everybody had heard it, and it was out. But there was a sense that it had tapped in to something very, very important about what that moment was all about.
And there's a very strong generational sense that you can be young enough not to be able to vote, but you're supposed to kill and be killed, you know, yeah. Die for your country.
That's... You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun? You're talking the sense that your fate is being determined by gray people out there who do not have your interest at heart. And Barry McGuire hit that hard. And this, of course, is at the moment when it's becoming clear to everybody that the war in Vietnam is not going away. In early 1965, there was probably still a chance that Lyndon Johnson could have pulled back from the war in Vietnam. That's hard to tell. It didn't happen. But he was aware that there were problems, and deep, deep problems with the war. His advisors knew that there were problems with the war, that they were approaching William Westmoreland, the general in charge of forces in Vietnam, called a Rubicon. After mid-1965, he said, "We are in for the long pull. I see no likelihood of achieving a quick, favorable end to the war." Now, nobody at that point thought that meant anything like what it wound up meaning, but still, it was there. But Johnson felt that he was facing a unanswerable problem. He felt that he had to live up to our role as leader of the free world. He knew it was going to harm his domestic agenda, and he was hearing voices telling him. McGeorge Bundy, one of the primary advisors, said there would be ever-present questions of how foreign soldiers would distinguish between Viet Cong and friendly Vietnamese farmers. When I view this array of difficulties, I'm convinced we should adhere to our past policy of keeping ground forces out of direct counterinsurgency role, out of combat, basically. That didn't happen. And exactly the problem that Bundy had predicted happened. By the end of the year, CBS News has broadcast a segment from the village of Cam Ney, which shows American soldiers lighting friendly villages, huts on fire in friendly villages, where all South Vietnamese, ostensibly the people were there to protect, are begging with them not to do what they're doing. And it was easy to point to soldiers at that point and say, well, they were out of control. But the fact is, they were in situations where with the Viet Cong, the communist guerrillas were in control of large parts of South Vietnam, and it was impossible for them to tell who was a friend and who was an enemy. And unsurprisingly, at a time when many of our soldiers in Vietnam are 19, 20 years old, they're young men. They're trying to protect themselves and their buddies, and they on occasion lost control. And of course, that led to the attacks. Johnson was just livid at CBS for showing the film. So it was unpatriotic. Maurice Safer, reporter, said, look, I'm doing my job, man. I'm telling you what's going on here. And people need to know what's happening there. So over the course of the year, more and more information begins to leak back about what a mess this war really is.
And what difference does it make that we're now in the era of TVs in almost every home, so the war is coming right into people's living rooms?
It's huge. People are seeing things from Vietnam that contrast, conflict, contradict what they're hearing from the politicians. The justifications for the war are ringing false to them. In 65, we've not yet begun to have a large number of veterans return from Vietnam with their stories. But the soldiers in Vietnam are experiencing things that they were not led to expect. There's a very famous battle of the Yadrang Valley, which takes place late in the year, when General Westmoreland has assured the American people that the North Vietnamese are not capable of standing up to American military power. And in the Yadrang Valley, which was a vicious battle in the sense of World War II battles, the famous battles there, or in Okinawa, or you name it, there is just a bloodbath goes on. And word begins to leak out. Specialist Jack Smith, whose father is a well-known journalist, wrote an article. He was in the Yadrang Valley and was grievously wounded. He survived. But he wrote an article that circulated widely, which he closes by saying, the scene might have been the devil's butcher shop. If anyone doubted Vietnam was going to be a real war, Smith's conclusion really should have put that to rest. And he said, they have operated on me twice. They tell me that I'll walk again, and that my legs are going to be fine. But no one can tell me when I will stop having nightmares. And for the soldiers, largely young men of color from rural areas, economically disadvantaged, there's still a student deferments, not very many college students are going to Vietnam. It's becoming clearer and clearer that the war is just a mess. Johnson attempts to deal with that by escalating the air war. Operation Arclight later in the year, early in the year, he bombs Hanoi and Haiphong, big cities in North Vietnam. Later in the year, Operation Arclight, they start bombing enemy positions in South Vietnam. By the end of the war, the United States has dropped more bombs on South Vietnam than it dropped in all the theaters of World War II. This is our friends, right? And it's clear, as Westmoreland and Bundy knew on some level, this was going to alienate the South Vietnamese and make the job impossible for our soldiers. But Johnson just follows the logic of the Cold War, kind of. If we fall,
was that logic?
Well, there was a logic which said that if we lose in Vietnam, then the next battle will be in Thailand. It was the domino theory.
Yeah.
That there would be dominoes falling until, you know, literally you'd hear some people, until we're fighting in the streets of San Francisco, was the absurd conclusion to that. But Johnson said at one point, and he's talking also about, in justifying the air war, he's saying, we have to support our troops on the ground there. And he says, we have kept our guns over the mantle and our shells in the cupboard for a long time now. I can't ask our American soldiers out there to continue the fight with one hand tied behind their back. And that's when General Westmoreland said that that decision to escalate the air war had brought us to a kind of Rubicon. And once we had crossed that, then at that point, there was literally no going back.
And that makes me think again of the Barry Maguire song, The Eve of Destruction. You mentioned this sort of tension between what we're doing abroad and then also the situation at home, because there's lines in the song Eve of Destruction about, you know, all the hate in Red China, but look at Selma, Alabama. I wonder if we can listen to just a little bit more of Eve of Destruction and talk about the relationship between what's going on abroad and then the racial situation at home.
Yeah, my blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation and marches alone. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, I don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Yeah, there's that sense that the world is just disintegrated around us. The anger is palpable in his voice.
Yeah, and you hear the rage. It's a very different kind of tone than some of the music from earlier in the 60s.
Very much so. And you hear that shift in tone within the student movement at the time, too. By 65, you've got Carl Oglesby, who's elected president of SDS during the year, condemning the war as inspired by the moneyed few who exploit their power by universal bureaucratic corruption, governmental indifference to the condition of men, police state oppression of honest dissent, no work and no wages. He's just mad. He's really, really angry. And a lot of his anger is directed not against the conservatives, but against liberals. At a November anti-war rally, first the huge anti-war rallies in Washington, Oglesby just lays into Kennedy's New Frontier, Johnson's Great Society together. He says, the original commitment in Vietnam was made by President Truman, a mainstream liberal. It was seconded by President Eisenhower, a moderate liberal. It was intensified by President Kennedy, a flaming liberal. Think of the men who now engineer that war, those who study the maps, give the commands, push the buttons, and tally the dead. Bundy, McNamara, Rusk, Lodge, Goldberg, the president himself. They are not moral monsters. They are all honorable men. They are all liberals.
And so what is his point then? If they're not monsters, yet it's leading to all this death.
That liberalism has to be confronted, that it has to be stopped. You have to throw your bodies on the gears of the machine, as Mario Savio said in the free speech movement and in Berkeley. Said you just have to do whatever you can to make it stop. If that means disrupting draft boards, whatever it means, it's by any means necessary, is really his take-home message.
And would 1965 be around the time that Berkeley was doing its teach-ins against the war?
The teach-ins begin at the University of Michigan in 65, and then they spread everywhere. They're at Berkeley, they're in Madison, they're in dozens and dozens of colleges across the United States. Students for Democratic Society, which has begun as a fairly small, focused organization, explodes. There are people everywhere who want to be part of SDS, but SDS doesn't really have any national infrastructure. And Oglesby, at some point, speaking for the national office, just throws up his arms and says, if you feel like you're a member of SDS, you're a member of SDS, which isn't good for coherence of policy or planning, or it makes it so that in many cases, the loudest, angriest voices control all of the actions.
You have a lot of protest songs happening, you know, whether it's Peter, Paul, and Mary or Joan Baez or, you know, tons of other ones. And, you know, one figure that always comes to mind when you think of the 60s is Bob Dylan.
Yeah. And it's interesting that Dylan, by 65, really isn't writing protest songs anymore. His politics are much more existential, much stranger in some ways, but they speak very, very deeply. Dylan is popular not only with the largely white student movement, but he's popular in amongst black militants. It's a couple of years later when the Black Panthers form, but Huey Newton and Bobby Seale talk about listening to Dylan to try to get a beat on what's going on in the world. And in 65, he releases what I consider the greatest album ever released, Highway 61 Revisited, with Like a Rolling Stone on it, which says, how does it feel to be on your own with no direction home, like a rolling stone? But also the song Ballad of a Thin Man, which raises a question which just reverberates throughout the entire rest of the decade. The sense that there's something going on, nobody has a grasp on it anymore.
You walk into the room with your pencil in your hand, you see somebody naked in you, you say, who is that man? You try so hard, but you don't understand just what you will say when you get home. Because something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones?
Bob Dylan with the Ballad of a Thin Man. We are going to look at civil rights from Selma to Watts when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honking. Don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord.
The Impressions, People Get Ready, words by Curtis Mayfield, right? I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Craig Werner. We are talking about 1965, the year the 60s changed. What made you think of using that song there?
Well, there are ways in which that song really sums up the feeling of the early civil rights movement, the sense that we're going somewhere, we're moving up, and that it's open to everybody. There's just such a gentle, lovely, welcoming energy to that song that speaks to the dreams of the early 1960s, that holds on to that sense that the new world is coming, that there will be a world where people can be judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin, as Dr. King put it. It's a dream, and it sinks so deeply into the whole African-American tradition, the trains that went from the South to the North to the promised land that turned out not to quite be the promised land that was hoped. But it also speaks to the fact that this really was a movement that was open to everybody. We think about Dr. King. We think about the John Lewis, the great leaders, Fannie Lou Hamer, and they all deserve the respect and honors they've received. But on some real basic level, the movement was about ordinary people. It was about a lot of African Americans and a significant number of white allies standing up in the face of injustice and demanding a change.
Would you say that's one of the focuses of your book on the 60s on freedoms would be to sort of recognize some of those unsung heroes, the ones that never make it into the history books?
Absolutely. That I spend time in some sections spotlighting John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Malcolm X, the usual suspects, the mm-hmm. icons, but also a lot of the stories I tell around ordinary people. And the campaign in Selma that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act is one of my favorites on that. I build that story around the story of Cheyenne Webb, who was a young African-American girl. She turned 9 during the campaign. She was 8 at the beginning of it, who was present in Selma. She got involved with the movement literally when she was walking to school and heard a rally going on and stuck her head in to see what was going on and was attracted to what was going on. She wound up, along with one of her friends, singing songs at the rallies, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, got my eyes set on freedom, keep your eyes on the prize. And there's a wonderful picture that was taken shortly before the march on this to be known as Bloody Sunday, when Cheyenne Webb and her friend Rachel are sitting on Dr. King's lap, and they are smiling. They're dressed up in their Sunday clothes, their hair in pigtails. And you can see both the love and the worry in Dr. King's face. And he asks Cheyenne Webb whether she has the strength to go on the march. This is actually right before the march from Selma to Montgomery, not Bloody Sunday. She was there on Bloody Sunday also. But she said, "My feet and legs are tired, but my soul still feels like marching." This 9-year-old girl who's giving her energy to it. And before she goes on that march, she has the revelation, has the awareness, the spark, that this is very dangerous. It's not just dangerous for Dr. King. It's not just dangerous for John Lewis. It's dangerous for everybody. And she wrote that all of a sudden the thought struck me, I might die. I might be in a march and someone would shoot and I'd be hit. Or I might be in a church when a bomb went off. Or I might be singing in front of a courthouse and a deputy might hit me with a club. I might die. And so, before going on the Montgomery March, she wrote out her own obituary and left it at home. And it read, Cheyenne Webb, 8 years, was killed today at Selma. She was one of Dr. King's freedom fighters. She was a student at Clark School, Selma. Cheyenne want all people to be free and happy.
Oh, that's
And she was on the bridge when they were attacked. Hosea Williams, one of King's attendants, swept her up in his arms and carried her off the bridge. When she got home, her father, who had kept his distance from the movement because it was risking your job to be associated with it, was so mad at what had happened, he got his shotgun and stood in the front yard and said, okay, if this is how it's going to be, this is how it's going to be. And that right there is a key moment, too, because it shows that even amongst the African-American community members who were not on the front lines of the marches, there was a deep anger. And that anger could turn into violent confrontation, if that's what it took. Malcolm X, who visited Selma during the campaign, shortly before he was assassinated that February, said it's by any means necessary. He says, you know, we're not asking for violence, but if you're going to attack, we're going to stand up and respond in kind. And so that sense of the growing anger, even after the passage of the Voting Rights Bill, would grow and grow throughout the year and peak later in the 60s.
And this would have been, what, a couple years after the Birmingham bombing that led to four dead girls?
Yeah, and Cheyenne Webb clearly knew about
that. She knew about that.
Yeah, that it was no secret. And white supremacist terrorist violence was no secret in the black communities of the South. It was the base. Even though the movement was nonviolent, it was armed. It was a movement that was based on armed self-defense. That's really, really important. A few years back, a couple of my colleagues at UW and I took students on a trip through the South to meet veterans of the movement. We talked to Colonel Stone Johnson, who was Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth's bodyguard in Birmingham at the center of that part of it. And one of our students asked Colonel Stone Johnson, the bodyguard, said, well, you guys were committed to nonviolence, but how on earth did you protect Reverend Shuttlesworth with that? And he just kind of smiled and said, with my nonviolent 45 police special. No one was naive about what it took. Nonviolence was a strong moral stance. Dr. King clearly believed in it deeply, but Dr. King was defended with weapons.
When you look at the way sometimes this time period, 1965, the civil rights struggles, the anti-war protests, are portrayed in typical textbooks in American schools, what do you think they miss?
Everything of importance? That's glib, but not entirely untrue. We've got a heroic version of the civil rights movement that says that John Kennedy called on America to support civil rights. Dr. King called on America to support civil rights. Good white folks came out and did it, and the laws were changed, and things were fine, kind of. The reality was much grimier than that. The reality involved a lot of violence, and it required strength to stand up to that violence. It required a great deal of courage on the part of ordinary people. It was about ordinary people more centrally than it was about the heroes, than it was about Dr. King. Dr. King was necessary, no question. Lyndon Johnson was necessary. Without Johnson's legislative genius, those Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act just don't get passed. I think it is literally true that no one else in American politics could have did that. I don't know as how those laws ever would have been passed without Johnson's genius at the time. But they also miss the fact that when the civil rights movement moves north and west, the tone changes in a fundamental way. That many of the white liberals who were willing to support the movement as long as it was about a Southern horror story, as long as it was about stopping obvious, open injustice and violence, as long as it was about standing up to George Wallace, it was fine. But when it came to the North and the West, the support eroded. And you see that very, very strongly in what happened in Watts shortly after the passage of the Civil Rights Bill. And there are two moments by Lyndon Johnson, from Lyndon Johnson, that I think exemplify the change. Speaking after Bloody Sunday in Selma, Johnson goes on TV and delivers just a fantastic speech. And at the end he says, "What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause, too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome." So he quotes the Civil Rights song at the end, which was just absolutely stunning when it happened. No one on the Civil Rights Movement expected that to happen. Some took it cynically. They said, yeah, well. But it brought tears to Dr. King's eyes. And he did get the law passed very shortly thereafter. But then, after the law is passed, signed in August, Watts explodes. And Johnson says, "What do they want? I'm giving them boom times and more good legislation than anybody else did. And what do they do? Attack and sneer. Could FDR do better? Could anybody do better? What do they want?" Well, the frustration is understandable and palpable. But Bobby Kennedy, who's gearing up to make his own political career, sounded I think a much more realistic note when he says, "There's no point in telling Negroes to obey the law. To many Negroes, the law is the enemy." And that was particularly the case in Chicago, in Milwaukee, in Boston, in L.A.
And I see how many of the points that are raised about 1965 have resonance today, for sure. We started the hour with the Beatles' Help. What song shall we end on, Craig?
Well, I want to go to Motown, usually thought of as the upbeat part of it, of the soundtrack, My Girl, and it's wonderful in many ways. But this particular song by Martha and the Vandellas, I think, sums up a growing sense that by the end of 1965, the situation has changed in some really fundamental way. Nowhere to Run.
I'm Emily Auerbach. My guest has been Craig Werner, and we've been talking about 1965, the year the 60s changed. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.